Hello, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast, a show about education and how it can change the world. I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and this is episode 6, We Shall Overcome. Whether you're an educator, a parent, a mentor, or a student, our purpose is to engage, enlighten, and empower you to make a difference. The theme of this episode is segregation, a topic I've had direct exposure to, both as an English teacher at Wilson High School and as I've traveled to schools and classrooms in all 50 states in America. In this episode, we'll be hearing from one of the original Freedom Writer teachers, Henry Wright, who tells his story of growing up in the Deep South and being invited to integrate his local high school. The next segment will be our Diary of the Day, where we'll be bringing you an excerpt from our book called Teaching Hope, written by the Freedom Writer teachers. And then we have our feature discussion with civil rights icon Dr. Terrence Roberts of the Little Rock Nine. Dr. Roberts shares his encounters with racism and discrimination as a child and how an extraordinary teacher encouraged him to be the executive of his own education and ultimately would lead him to volunteering to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. Dr. Roberts describes in great depth what it was like before, during, and after that critical moment in history. Thank you for joining us for another episode. As you listen to these stories, I invite you to reflect on racism and discrimination that you might have seen or experienced in your lifetime, and how you talk about it with your students, your own children, your families, your friends. I hope you find incredible insights from these two guests about how to candidly confront our past so together we can build a better, more equitable future. Now, here's our Freedom Writer teacher, Henry Wright. Henry joins us today by phone.
I was born and raised in North Augusta, South Carolina. The first school that I attended was Tri-Union Elementary School. At that time, in 1957, when I began school, it was set aside. It was in the African-American community. All African-American students with all African-American teachers with an African-American principal. But the educators there really went beyond what was in the book and tried to teach us life skills, how to survive in a world which was separate. I mean that African-American students, you went to African-American schools, Caucasian students went to Caucasian schools. We rode older buses that had been handed down from the Caucasian schools. On one of the roads coming in was where the Caucasian people lived, but they would not let the school bus come through that road. They said it made too much noise, which it was an older bus. And many times it did make more noise than a new bus. We had to come through the African-American community, which was a dirt road, an unpaved road. And many times when there was hard rains, it was hard for the bus to come through this road. Many times we would have to stop where our road had washed out, cross the gap to get to the school.
Did you understand as the civil rights movement was unfolding, be it watching the Little Rock Nine or sit-ins or going over the bridge in Selma or Reverend Martin King, did you understand that as a child that things were changing?
We could see things changing gradually. The only thing I knew about the Little Rock Nine was, you know, it showed up in the Augusta Chronicle Heralds and we heard about it. Arkansas was like another world away. That was the concept in our minds that, okay, that happened in Little Rock, Arkansas. We're in North Augusta, South Carolina. We're in Belvedere, South Carolina. Our place of refuge was Sundays in the church, you know, and we sang the song, We Shall Overcome. That was like 1957. And so you're talking about 8 years later, where I was, they was trying to make some changes.
You made the conscious, difficult choice to integrate a high school in your community. It's like a two-part question. The first part is I want you to tell me about the decision to integrate and how difficult that would be. And then I want you to talk about when you actually made that decision, the reaction. that it wasn't so easy for those that were embracing you into their school or are not embracing you?
Around 1965, there was a decision made in the county that I live that because of Little Rock 9, which had Central High School had been integrated, that it was going to be for a trial basis in my county. And so they advocated for certain students to come. Then in 1966, the guidance counselor at Jefferson High School approached me and said, I think you'd be a nice candidate to go. Psychologically, I had to deal with the notion of, should I go to this school and meet resistance, or should I stay at my school and just follow the norm? In the spring of 67, I had the notion and the thinking forward that, yes, this is what I'm going to do. But then I spoke with my parents about it, and my dad said, are you sure this is what you want to do? He said, because if you do it, then there's no turning back. If you go, you can't go for a day and then say, well, I changed my mind, I'm going to go back. And so, even though he was an uneducated man, he said, if you're going to make this decision, then you got to stick with it. And probably the hardest part of this decision, Aaron, was the morning of going to the bus stop that very first day. I was up early. My dad was up earlier than I was. And he said, well, this is the day. Are you sure? And I said, yes. So for the first part of the walk to the bus stop, I was with students from Jefferson High School. The sun was shining. It felt like I was in a heat wave. I remember I always wore like an Oxford shirt with dress slacks, with string up shoes. I just had basically a binder with paper in it. In those days, you carried your books under your arms, but it was the first day of school, so all I had was a binder, pen, and pencils.
Henry, how old were you at this moment?
16.
16 years old. So you're 16 years old and the sun is beating on you. Is it August or September? What month of the year was it?
August. The South Carolina and Georgia schools normally always start in August. It's very muggy. I was walking. There's no mom, no dad, just me, one African-American teenager, walking past these Caucasian houses, and then I reach the stop sign, a street perpendicular to the one I'm walking on, and there are young men there, probably four or five Caucasian guys, they're smoking cigarettes, and they said, where are you going? I said, to school. And they chuckled, aren't you at the wrong bus stop? Even though it had been advertised that schools were going to do some integration, it hadn't got into people's mind yet. And so I'm like, no. I said, this is the bus that goes to North Augusta Senior High School, right? And they were like, yes. And then they kind of had conversation among themselves. And I waited, and I waited. I guess I could have ran away. I could have ran to the right or ran to the left. But something kept telling me, you need to do this. And I saw the bus, and of course, I let everyone else get on the bus first, and I got on the bus, and the bus driver said, where you going? I said, to school. And then there was that laughter, chuckle among them. And I walked about three-fourths of the way back on the bus and sat down. My heart was pounding. Thoughts was in my mind, you know, what are they gonna say? What's gonna happen? Are we gonna have a conflict here? And you have to remember in those days that if you was Caucasian, then you were right. You had to be proven wrong. If you was African American, you were automatically judged wrong. You had to prove that you were right. Even with the city bus of Augusta that came over into North Augusta, it was known that African Americans sit past the second door first and then kind of move your way up. This was after Rosa Parks did her sit down. But what I was trying to do was minimize the amount of conflict on my first day at the school. So I figured that if I sat somewhere near the back, that I would be okay. No one would say, this is their seat, blah, blah, blah. So in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, least resistance, I'll just go sit about 3/4 way back, and that was it. At the next stop, a young lady, a beautiful young lady, gets on, and she looks around and she saw me, and she turned to the bus driver and she said, "There's a damn nigger on the bus." And of course, everybody chuckles, you know. And he said, "Yeah, he's going to school now." And we go on down the road.
What did a 16-year-old boy think? I mean, take us back to that moment. What was that like to have this young girl? The fact that you said she was a beautiful young girl just makes it even more painful. Tell me about that word and its intention.
Yeah. During the 50s and 60s, it was a word that was used in a derogatory term. And today it still has a derogatory connotation to it. But back in those days, when the Caucasian people used it, they was inflicting verbal hurt upon you. And so when she got on the bus that day, and mind you that I had spoken with the young man, I'd spoken with the bus driver, and there were other people on there, that word was not used until she got on there. And then there's a hurdle, you know. Do I get attacked? Do I say anything? I was the only African-American person on that bus. The only. No, I don't say anything. I just look out the window. I knew that I had signed up for this to go to North Augusta Senior High School. My dad had said, "You need to do this." You know, it kind of died down as the bus goes along the route and we finally arrived at the school. I know that there are a few other African Americans. I think it was 4 or 5 other African American students that was going to be there. And the principal meets the bus. He's a former football coach, white guy with balding head, a sharp pointed nose. And they hurdled us into the gymnasium. Everybody have a seat. And the principal come out and he begins by saying, "There have been some changes this year, but we're going to make it." And I think that he was referring to this our first year with some African-American students here, but we're going to have to make the best of it because the county had put down this mandate that we were going to do it. And a few years after that, they went full-fledged integration. My nieces and nephews had the opportunity to go without any resistance. So in a way, we were the Jackie Robinsons of education at North Augusta High School.
Henry, what I love about our relationship is that every Sunday morning I get beautiful thoughts and words and sermons from you. And I know when you feel the Spirit, you emote and cry. And you said something earlier about singing songs like "We Shall Overcome." So I'm wondering if you would sing a verse or two. I love that you referenced it. So if you know even just one line.
"We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday, someday. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday." And that day is here. We're making progress.
Perfection.
Our chorus teacher, music teacher, that was one of the songs that we sang over and over. I don't know if she was looking into the future and seeing that, okay, integration was beginning. But I think that each student needs to find a copy of that and to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause, to dream the impossible dream.
I'm so honored to have Henry Wright be part of our Freedom Writer family. Henry is one of the original Freedom Writer teachers who collaborated to write a book called Teaching Hope, a book written by, for, and about teachers to help other teachers going into this profession to make a difference. So for this episode's Diary of the Day, we thought it would be apropos to share an excerpt written by our very own Henry Wright. It is diary number 15 in Teaching Hope. As a teacher, Henry draws upon his experience of integrating his own high school to reach across so-called boundaries and develop trust with a student of a different race. The entry will be read by freedom writer Narada Cohens.
If I had stayed at my previous high school for my last 2 years, life may have been easier. I wouldn't have known this type of rejection. However, it made me a better person and a better teacher. 3 years ago, a white girl walked into my classroom. She had transferred from another school because she was having problems. Later, she confided in me that her parents had divorced. I connected with her because, like her, I felt out of place when I was in high school. When she got in trouble in other teachers' classes, she came to my classroom to plead her case. I always listened and gave her advice on what she should do. Recently, I ran into her in a store shopping. She approached me and gave me a big hug. She said, "You just don't know how much I appreciate what you did for me." I asked, "What are you doing these days?" She said, "I'm attending college and working." Trust wasn't a part of the equation when I went to high school, but trust is part of my equation. I don't agonize going to the bus stop anymore.
Like Henry, the teachers that come through our teacher training institutes are so inspiring, so humble, and heartfelt, and are genuinely committed to making a difference in the lives of each and every student who walks into their classroom. So if any of you listeners are educators of any kind and think you might be interested in learning more about the Freedom Writer Teacher Institutes or how to become a Freedom Writer teacher, please reach out to us. We want to hear from you and learn about your mission to make your students' lives better. So send us an email at fwi@freedomwritersfoundation.org and follow us on social media. We look forward to connecting with you and helping make your journey just a bit brighter, a bit better. The time has come for our featured discussion. I'm so humbled to share with you my conversation with Dr. Terrence Roberts. Our incredible guest today is an activist, a fighter of the good fight, and has spent his entire life making our world a better place. He was one of those courageous young people known as the Little Rock Nine. His teachers knew him as Terrence, but I want to refer to him as Dr. Terrence Roberts. And so it is an honor and privilege to have each and every one of our listeners meet this advocate and this change agent. Welcome to the show here in Pasadena at the Gamble House, Dr. Roberts.
Well, thank you, Erin, for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be here.
So many of our listeners are teachers and students, and I'd love to go backwards so that we can fill in the historical context of what you did and why it was so heroic at a time when most young people had the courage to do what most adults did not have the courage to do. So can you take us back to your youth and what was happening, not just in Little Rock, Arkansas, but what was happening in schools around America?
Well, you have to remember, when I was born, I came on the scene in December 1941. At that time, this entire country was operating under the dictum of separate but equal, which was very interesting because the emphasis was on the separate. The equal part never materialized. I didn't know any of this at first. I was a typical infant, and as soon as I became a sentient individual, able to ferret out meaning, I began wondering what on earth is going on. For instance, as black people, we were restricted in terms of where we could live in a given city. So there were, quote, black areas of town. In fact, in many cases, black people couldn't even buy properties. Everything was separate. Separate places to eat, separate places to shop. Speaking of shopping, as a black person, you could not try on clothing in department stores. You had to eyeball it to see if it might fit. But once you bought it, it was yours. No possibility of return if you were a black customer. Churches, schools, libraries, public parks. There was a great public park in Little Rock, Fair Park. Black people were not allowed to swim in the pool there. Interestingly enough, we could spend our money in some of these places under very restricted circumstances. I used to eat at a place called the Crystal Burger in Little Rock. That place, like all the others, discriminated. As a black person, you could walk in and order food to go, but you could not, under any circumstance, sit down and eat your food in the Crystal Burger. Now, when I was 13, I wandered in there one day, and I ordered hamburger, fries, whatever I was getting, but I forgot the rules momentarily. So once I placed the order, I jumped up on a stool to wait for my order, and at that point, everything and everybody became absolutely quiet, and I became the center of everyone's attention. No words were spoken, but the unspoken message was very clear. And with something like this, boy, you better get some sense in your head. And I got it very quickly, and I jumped down off that stool and ran out of that place. I canceled my order. And there I am on the sidewalk on the way home just crying because I'm thinking, this can't go on. This makes no sense. At that point, I realized that I was a very vulnerable person because I had simply internally refused to go through this charade of obeying the rules of segregation. I couldn't do it anymore. I began to ask questions. Many people wouldn't talk to me because they said, you don't want to bring that up. You want to get us into trouble. Be quiet about those things, which is frightening to me because here was a reality that needed to be changed. I knew that. I understood that even as a young person. But many people didn't even want to talk about it. There was so much fear, so much reluctance to engage around these issues. One, because this stuff was so deeply rooted, embedded in the psyche and character of this nation. We can go all the way back to the year 1619, for instance, and start with the very first shipload of people who were brought here from Africa for the express purpose of providing labor, very specific kinds of labor, and to be done for free, unpaid. Now, 1619 was not the start of the institution that we know of as slavery. That was a few years later, but that was inevitable. And so from 1619 to 1954, that's 335 years, by law, it was possible to discriminate against people based on racial group membership. Now you think about that, 1619 to 1954, it only changed legally in 54 with the Brown decision. But before that, law and custom combined to keep this racial hierarchy in place. It's overpowering when you think about it. The mental sort of impact for me was profound. 335 years this has been going on? I was 13 years old when the Supreme Court ruled in the Brown case. Now at that point, I could see a glimpse of light. Nothing that would overturn anything, but at least here's a possibility that things might change. And that was realized a few years later, in 1957, with the desegregation of Central High School.
For our listeners who have not reached that part of their history books now, tell them what that meant, that the Supreme Court of the United States of America was going to overturn this ruling for a 13-year-old boy. What did that feel like?
This was a tremendous change, although it was just the law. And I wasn't naive enough to think that anything else was going to change with it. So things social, cultural, psychological, emotional, ideological, that was all going to be the same as before. That much I knew even then. Now, and I make a strong point about this because in this country, we say that we are law-abiding people. I didn't know how it was going to happen, honestly, in 1954, because nothing in Little Rock suggested that they were about to change anything.
As a young person, did you understand what integrating a school would look like?
Well, yes, I did understand that, and I knew no such thing was ever going to happen in this country. We might, for instance, desegregate Central High School on a limited basis. Limited, meaning that there were only 9 of us, and this was experimental. I also knew that there wasn't any support for this notion at all in the general public. Now, lawmakers, from time to time, would suggest that perhaps we needed to push and change, but they didn't have the support of the entire population. We still don't, actually. Sometimes people say we have more segregation today than we had then. I disagree with that. I said, no, we don't have any more or any less. It's about the same. It's business as usual, because when you think about it, over 95% of us as American citizens choose monoracial, monocultural lives, and that's supported by all the social data. Now, what does that mean? That means that we have not yet reached a point where we're willing to grant parity to all people, regardless of racial group membership. But I still, at that point, you have to realize, growing up in Little Rock, under those very harsh circumstances, legalized segregation, if you don't figure out what's going on, you could wind up being killed, for one thing. So I needed to be very alert and very aware of all those dynamics. We weren't shielded from that. And my own life experience exposed me to raw racism. You know, getting to Central High School wasn't the first time I'd gotten beaten up by white people. No, that was just the way of life under those circumstances. Because, you see, because of the law and because of customs, white people could do unto black people with impunity. No law was going to prosecute a white person for beating up or killing a black person. It just wasn't to be done.
You were able to be an activist as a teenager in 1957, before you had that rallying cry of these other iconic civil rights moments. So let's go backward towards those early teen years when you had this opportunity to step forward, to stand up, and to do something.
School was actually a very good learning ground for me. We had very dedicated teachers, and they determined that they were going to push us toward excellence, which they did. For instance, first grade, I walk into this segregated classroom at Gibbs Elementary. Miss Waugh is my teacher. We're there, a group of six-year-olds gathered around her, and she looks at us, and she says, "You kids, you have to become executives in charge of your own learning. You've got to take on CEO responsibility for your own independent learning enterprise." And I thought, wow. Now, I don't know if she truly realized what kind of fire she ignited at that point, but for me, it was a raging inferno. So right there in September of 1947, I established the Terry Roberts Learning Academy. Now, what that did, that kind of send-off did, was to propel me forward, and my quest to learn was even greater. I needed to find out as much as I could, as fast as I could, because I realized we were living in a situation where we could literally be killed at any moment, and it would be of little concern to people in power and control. I paid attention, and it was good that I did, because it helped me to learn how to navigate the terrain. If you learn how to navigate the terrain early in life, then it's a lot easier as you grow. So by the time I was 13, when you look at the situation and you realize that this is how it's always going to be unless you opt to change it, that's a point of decision that demands you make the choice to go forward or just stay in limbo. I couldn't conceive of myself staying in that limbo because it would have been tantamount to living no life at all, honestly. So I chose to volunteer. The school board in Little Rock decided they were going to desegregate Central High School, and they requested volunteers at a school assembly, and I raised both hands. The reason for that being, this was the moment I had longed for. I knew this is my opportunity. And the other eight of our group felt the very same way. And there were others who felt the same way as well. In fact, there were more than nine students who volunteered. But I think we probably had around 150 volunteers. And then we went home and explained to our parents that we had volunteered, and you could hear vetoes being stamped all over Little Rock, you know. A lot of parents were so frightened that their kids would be killed, that our blood would flow in the streets of Little Rock. It was life-threatening. So a lot of parents said, "Oh no, you're not killing my kid."
Take us to that kitchen table with your mother and father and telling your parents, "I volunteered." What was that conversation like?
You know, interestingly enough, very little drama. I presented my case, and they listened, and they responded with, "Okay, we will support your decision 100%. Nothing prepared me for that. When I first came home and reported that I had volunteered, I told them what I had done, but I also had a very strong argument that I was going to make, which I was going to win. I never had to use it. I can't believe it, for one thing. The willingness to say yes. Now, how they got there, I don't know, because they weren't politically active. They weren't people on the front lines. They were just, you know, hardworking folk. My dad always had three jobs, which makes sense because there were nine in the family and we didn't have a lot of money. My mom worked too. She had her own catering business. She worked out of the home. But in terms of this issue, schooling for their kids, because they were adamant about learning. I mean, we all seven of us, when we went to school, we already knew how to read. You know, we knew what we were in for. But to have the courage, I don't know. Someone asked me once, would you allow your kids? I'm yelling, screaming, no, no, I would not. See, I know too much. I know too much. And so it would be hard for me as a parent to say yes, even though theoretically and objectively I would want to say yes. I don't think I have that same whatever my parents had. I think they realized that this might end in disaster, that my child might be killed, but it is worth the risk given what's at stake. So let's see what happens.
Take us back to that morning, and how did you prepare for what was about to unfold that the world watched?
Well, the governor of Arkansas, a man by the name of Orville Faubus, had been on television the night before, having called out the state guard. But his response was, I've called out the guard to keep the peace. Now, naively, I bought that message. So that morning, preparing for school, was not a very different morning. I dressed, I prepared, I walked, thinking, well, this is going to be different. I could hear the rumblings of the mob, though, as I approached, and my fear level began to go up. Fortunately, there were reporters and photographers around, and I was literally surrounded by reporters and photographers. I could hear the mob, I could hear what they were saying, and it was pretty scary stuff, because the decibel level was very high. The voices were screaming out all kinds of racist invective, every name you can think of. And there were people in the mob that first day. There were grandmothers and grandfathers in the mob holding their grandkids' hands. I noticed that right away and thinking, this is really indicative of where we have come, because these little kids have no defense against the elders who are dragging them into this. And then the older kids, of course, were doing it on their own. And then when you look at the photos, there's one iconic photo I think everybody in the world has seen. And that's Elizabeth, one of our group of nine, walking in front of the school, poised with her dark glasses and flaring skirt. And then right behind her is Hazel Bryant. Hazel is, her mouth is open so wide, and she's spewing out this racist invective. Now, unfortunately for her, because as an adult, she's changed her mind, but she can't change that photo. For me, at least, I understood what was going on. See, I didn't accept any of that as definitive of who I was. I saw it simply as messages about who they were. The message was pretty frightening, to be sure, and I was scared, no question about it. I'd never been that afraid in my life. But at the same time, I realized that it was just a matter of maintaining my definition of me, not giving in to the impulse to give in to what they were saying. And I took that with me. Once we did get into school, I took that same notion with me so that I could maintain balance.
When you were in the school and in class, how were the students and teachers? Did they treat you with respect? Was there equality, or was there still segregation within an integrated school?
The truth is, no, we were not accorded any rights whatsoever. We were treated with disdain by most people most of the time. Although, I must say, in terms of students, teachers, and administrators, they lined themselves up along a continuum. There was no unanimity of thought. Unfortunately, they tended to cluster at the end that I might describe as hating us with vile hatred. There was that to deal with. But at the other end, there were few people who thought differently, who thought we had a right to be there, that we should be given a chance. Unfortunately, their voices were nearly mute because they were under instructions from the larger body saying, look, if you give voice to those sentiments, we will kill you. So it was very tough. Now, the only thing that changed was if we happened to have a teacher who was from the other end of the continuum, she or he would maintain order and would not allow the kids to do these things. But lo and behold, if you wound up in the classroom with one of the vile haters and the teacher was in charge, you were in big trouble. I assumed I would receive an F in English because the English teacher hated me with such vile passion. And she confronted me one day. She said, why do you want to come to our school? Why don't you go back to your own school? I was shocked. I didn't know what to say to her, so I just smiled and walked off. I got an A, which is very surprising. In fact, when I told a friend of mine that I got an A, he started rolling on the floor laughing. Finally, he was able to talk. He said, you know why you got to A, don't you? I said, no. He said, that woman did not want a chance ever having you in class again.
Demographically, did students get pulled from that school because you were there? Were their parents?
Well, they pulled themselves out. First day we walked in, several white students just got up and left. They didn't leave before giving us a harangue about why they were leaving. You know,
so
they,
to your face, as storming out of the classroom.
Sort of like their last statement. You're here and we don't like you and we're leaving. This is my paraphrase. We're never coming back. And they joined the mob. And they were there every day in the mob. And I always thought that was peculiar because here are kids, our age group kids, who are saying, in essence, we will abandon any attempt to educate ourselves using this formal institution as long as you're in there. And we will also stand here in the mob. We won't go to the library or do our independent reading. We're going to be here harassing you because we don't like you. And so every class we went into, we lost several white kids. Some white parents, fearing for the safety of their children, pulled them out. Some who were absolute adherents to racist ideology pulled their kids out. So for several reasons, they were pulling kids out. There were people in the neighborhood, in the white neighborhoods, who implored parents with kids to pull their kids out. So all of this was going on. And yet we had some white parents who said no to that. Some white students who said no, not in great numbers. But one young woman stands out, Robin Woods, was in my algebra class. I would often be in class with no books, no notebooks, no pens or pencils, because these would be ripped from my hands and broken apart. One day, Robin, sensing my plight, pulled her desk over and we shared her book. Now, if you know anything at all about the great taboos in the South, or in this country for that matter, a white female in close proximity to a black male sends the temperature up. So when Robin pulled her desk over, you could feel the temperature rising. You could hear the tone changing. She suffered greatly. She got beaten up on the way home that day and other days. But she was stalwart. See, Robin was very different. Robin grew up in a household with her mom and sister, the three of them, single parent home. But her mom was a devout Christian person who'd always taught them to treat everybody in the universe as their peer. So they were well prepared for that. And their mom was not the person who would just give lip service to that. She lived that life. And so they were able to withstand all of these folk who were in opposition. But rare, like I said, she was very much alone in that regard. In fact, I could count on one hand the number of students who would fit that category.
For context, how many students attended Central High at that time?
About 2,000.
So less than five were sympathetic.
Yes, and not surprising when you understand about the 335 years of preparation, about the attitudes that were so ingrained. See, I often wondered, when I looked at the faces of these kids, what's going on? Why are they so intense? And I was gradually learning, so that's it. See, they have been baptized into this ideology of racism. They have been told, you're white, ergo, you are better than any black person. And then we show up, nine of us, and we don't say a word. We just walk in, and already they're sensing something. Maybe this stuff they told me is a lie. I don't know what they're thinking, but they're not happy in any case. And they take out their anger on us. And so we become targets. Now, we've taken a vow of nonviolence, and yet they don't respect that. They simply see us as stationary targets, and we have to modify our version of nonviolence to include running. We were in serious danger every single day we were in that school. And I can say with candor that had not the soldiers been there, we would not have made it. No way.
So you had the National Guard and the Army outside the school, inside the school. What protected you walking down a hallway?
Well, we had the Army inside, too.
Oh, my. I did not realize that.
Oh yeah. We would not have been able to live in there without the Army.
So were they escorting you from here?
From class to class, from class to class.
And did they sit in the classroom?
No, they were not allowed in the class. And that was a problem.
Where does that inner strength come from to walk through a crowd that is chanting and screaming and spewing hate, to be poised and have dignity and to have grace?
Well, I think part of it started very early in my relationship with my mom. There were seven of us kids in the family, and my mom was careful to instruct each one of us. One, we had to know who we were. And it didn't just stop with knowing our names, but we had to know who we were in terms of our purpose on the planet. Why are you here? What does it matter if you leave? And she used to say things like, you're not going to be here very long. The human lifespan is very short. And she wasn't trying to frighten us with that information, but she wanted us to know we had just enough life force to sustain us for however many years we were going to spend here. And we could waste some of that life force hating others, being revengeful, being resentful. But we could, on the other hand, choose to use all that life force to build character, to build the persons that we were and who we wanted to be. I opted for the second option. Fighting hate with hate didn't make much sense.
Can you tell our listeners about who was the president and your governor at that time and how this was so political, not just in the state of Arkansas or the city of Little Rock or just Central High, but this became a national story?
President at that time was Dwight Eisenhower. Now, Eisenhower was of the mind that states should have the right to make their own decisions. He was reluctant to get involved in this because he thought it would be interfering with states' rights. And of course, the governor of Arkansas supported that. But when things got to be a little hot in terms of the opposition, the president finally determined that he had to send in the army. They came in the town one evening and they had to cross the Arkansas River. Trucks, convoys, they came in through North Little Rock. They came across the bridge and the sun was so positioned to show them coming in with this halo-like effect. I was so happy to have these soldiers. They could not have killed anybody, though, because as I found out years later, they didn't have any bullets. I'm glad I didn't know it at the time. But the commanding general, a man by the name of Edwin Walker, had said to them, "You cannot have any ammo." His fear was that the troops might be so impacted by the mob that they would maybe reflexively pull the trigger. And then we would have a dilemma. How can you explain U.S. soldiers killing citizens? And so you just said, okay, no bullets. I will eliminate that one.
Can you talk about the ripple effect on the negative side before we celebrate some of the positive?
There were all kinds of death threats. We had hate mail by the bushel every day. Well, 6 days a week. We had phone calls 7 days a week, 24/7, actually. And we had drive-bys, even though we didn't have that terminology. We had drive-bys in the neighborhood. It quickly became public knowledge where we lived. Black people lost jobs. Black people who had kids in school lost jobs. Black people who had no kids at all lost jobs. It was just a full-scale opposition force in motion. They were vocal, they were angry, and they wanted us to know it.
Does there come a time where you stop picking up the phone, stop opening up the envelope, stop looking out the window, or did you want to read what people were writing? Did you want to hear what they were saying?
I wasn't that interested in the mail or the phone calls, but I knew it was important to hear what people were saying, well, for self-preservation. But you know, even as a young kid, my thought about the hate mail wasn't so much about the craziness of what was written there, but the fact that it was grammatically incorrect. I wanted to correct it and send it back, but most of them wouldn't have a return address. So there was I, thwarted in my purpose to help them at least speak clearer. And my mom told me something later on that I hadn't even considered, because I chided her once. She would answer the phone all the time. I said, "Mom, you don't have to answer every phone call, because you know 90% of them or more will just be filled with racist invective." And she would answer anyway. But then years later, we'd actually moved from Little Rock. We were now in L.A. And she told me one of the reasons she answered the phone all the time was she didn't want to miss the call that informed her that I was no longer among the living. Now, that was something that was pretty scary for me even when I heard it, because I felt all of this guilt and psychological distress because I had put her through that ordeal. And yet she saw it as her job as mother to be the buttress, if you will, between me and all that madness. I caught her one day burning hate mail. And I rushed in. I said, "Mom, you can't burn the hate mail. That stuff has historical significance." And she swore. I didn't even know she knew those words. But that was her way of saying, this is my job. You can't take that away from me. So I relented.
I'm glad this is a podcast, so our listeners can't see me sobbing as I'm doing this interview. I'm just so inspired that you had this calling that was bigger than yourself. And did you know at that time the ripple effect, the doors that would be opened, and how you would be this change agent for teachers like myself to be drawn into this profession and to do right by our kids?
Not at that time, no. It was mainly about survival, day to day. But then along the way, what I've come to realize is it's actually rather tragic. That was the way things were. That is the way things are. And I say that because even though we're in the year 2018, none of this stuff has literally changed. I mean, there are people who have bought into what I call the progress narrative, but I challenge that. I challenge that because what I see is that we really haven't made many strides forward. Now, we have done things to bring people up to the starting line, but in my book, that's not progress. That's where things should have been anyway. See, I would prefer that I didn't have to do this. I would prefer to live my life, to use my life force for however many years I have, to be the best Terry Roberts possible. But here I have to contend with so many crazy things. For instance, a woman asked me once, I was doing a group, and she raised her hand and she says, Dr. Roberts, would you prefer to be called Black or African American? And I didn't say anything, and I looked at her, and she looked at me, and then all of a sudden I realized there was this look of consternation on her face. And I said, well, what? She said, well, aren't you going to answer? I said, well, I would love to answer, but you've only given me two options. Could you please give me some more options? She didn't have any more. So I suggested she call me Terry Roberts, which I thought was valid, workable. She didn't seem satisfied. It's that sort of world we live in, you know? Boxes and categories and designations and walls and fences and separation, all of that stuff, it means that we can't truly live life the way it might have been lived if we weren't saddled with all of that craziness. And yet here we are in 2018, just as befuddled as we've ever been.
I'm hopeful that our listeners want to change the status quo. I hope that our listeners are not complacent. So what would you inspire them to do if you had a call to action?
The first place to change, of course, is self. And that is an inside-out work, changing so that you become the kind of person you want to envision seeing around you. You have to model what that looks like. You have to really confront self. You have to go naked to a mirror and look in the eyes of that person staring back at you and ask really hard questions. What am I ready to do to literally change the way things are? And if you're willing to stick with it, accept the fact that it's going to be tough. There's no question about it. Because as Americans, we are practically addicted to comfort. And that's a deterrent, you know? But in order to change, we have to choose to be uncomfortable with ourselves and with others. We have to make that choice. If we're not willing to make that kind of choice, nothing's going to happen. It's difficult, but in one way, it's actually quite simple. And that is to learn the truth about who we are, who we have been. I think if we were to start doing that today, if we were to start teaching all the young kids about the truth of who we have been, it will be a lot easier, because it's not an indictment of the country when you know the truth. You're not saying anything negative. You're just saying, oh, so that's who we were. And then ask yourself the question, is that who we want to continue to be? Because we can make the change.
In honor of their truth, may we all be willing to go through hell for a heavenly cause. That concludes our show this week. This episode was produced and edited by Bryce Serrier with production assistance from Clay Amontorp. A special thanks goes to Lori Corngable and Don Hahn and Jennifer Trotu at the Gamble House. Above all, thanks to all of you, our listeners. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with your friends and leave us a review so that we can lift, we can learn, and we can live our stories to the fullest. Our call to action today is this: may we be executives of our own education. may we choose to be uncomfortable. And as Dr. Roberts encouraged us, may we confront ourselves to literally change the way things are. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.